All right, welcome into the latest edition of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, the TSC, which I feel has legs.
Hashtag TSC.
Hashtag TSC. Shout us out. I am your Bengals beat writer, Paul Daner Jr., here with Politics Extra, Politics Insider, Jason Williams. Jason, how are you doing? It's been an insane week around here.
It has a tough week in Cincinnati, and just, you know, condolences to the families who lost loved ones and friends who lost loved ones in the shooting last week on Fountain Square. And it's so weird. It's like you just sound so cliche in saying this, but it's just so happy about how the police responded and just so appreciative of what they did and how they rallied and how the community has now rallied around them as well and just rallied around this whole thing.
There's no doubt. And you know, we don't want to bog down with going into the news and everything here. Yep. I mean, we have – there is plenty of coverage on Cincinnati.com. I recommend you to go the Sunday cover story – was incredible, really taking you inside and giving you a feel for everything what happened. If you have not read it yet, I highly recommend
going. 4 minutes and 28 seconds. Yes. Dan Horn and Sharon and Coolidge. Sherry.
Yeah.
Both tremendous reporters and really worked hard to get on the inside of this and took readers through this. And I think it's the best piece of journalism I've seen out of this whole thing.
Yeah, it's incredible, really incredible, and you know, props to them for all the hard work that really everybody here put into it. But to have that piece to show for, particularly Follow Up on Sunday, is incredible. To say, hey, if you want to get into the news of that, I highly recommend that. We're here to try to add a different perspective. That's what this podcast is about. This podcast is about what's affecting people in Cincinnati and try to really, you know, this medium allows us to dive a little deeper. And so we're actually, you know, it's only our second episode, but I think we're going to kind of alter the format a little bit because we have the ability to bring in somebody who we really think is perfect to have this conversation with. And he's former police officer, now retired, recently retired, Derek Bauman. And you know, to can really talk us through so many elements of this that I don't know that people fully understand. He has an incredible perspective, and so when we're going to really discuss it, it just seems like we should bring him in. And so that's kind of the plan for this. You're not going to get as much of Jason and I know people are sad about that. They want us. Barry. They need us. But this is great conversation.
It is. I'm really glad to have Derek in today. He's spent 26 years as a police officer, the latter part of his career in Mesa Police Department. Lives in Over the Rhine, ran for city council last year. I think you'll probably see him on city council, run again for city council, and I think we'll see him on city council at some point in the future. He has a very, I think, unique perspective in that he really sees all angles of police community relations and policing, and you know, it's tough to bring in a police officer beyond, like, you know, the department spokesperson or something in the wake of something like this. A lot of officers aren't allowed to talk about it, or they don't want to talk about it. But to have Derek, who is very, very engaged in the community with his experience living in Over the Rhine, how much he cares about Cincinnati, I feel like he's the perfect guest to have today in the wake of this tragedy.
He has so much insight, and so I just want to go ahead and we can get to Derek, and we're going to kind of just try to attack this from all different angles, from logistics to how this affects cops to how this affects the people and how the people help affect the cops. You know, I know people don't talk about how the officers are so helped by what's happened. I mean, the community has just rallied so much around this and trying to help everybody involved. And, you know, in an understanding of how, like you mentioned, how incredible the first responders and the officers were in this case, because this thing could have been 100 times worse.
And I'm really interested to hear what he says too about the training aspect. And you, we see four officers who in the body cam who, you know, ultimately fired shots, but you know, probably ultimately there were 100. I don't know. We don't know how many officers were on the scene and in the perimeter. I'm curious to hear, like, where does everybody know where to go?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And how do they execute it so well? So we're going to get to that after that conversation, which is going to be way more lengthy than our normal interviews are, because we really want to give this an opportunity to stretch out, because it's going to be such a unique perspective. We'll come back and we'll try to lighten it up a little bit as we all try to move forward. We have to kind of be a little lighter, and we'll wrap it up after the conversation with Derek. So Jason and I will be back to finish this off. But for now, let's bring in retired police officer Derek Bauman. All right, now time for the interview segment of That's a Cincinnati Podcast. And, you know, I'm excited to bring in retired police officer Derek Bauman here with us. You know, this interview segment is meant to really just bring in a unique voice to whatever the topic is that we want to go into. Sometimes that'll be somebody here that works here that's been covering events. Sometimes we have such unique perspective, somebody like Derek, that you want to have them in-house. And so you, 26 years, you were a police officer, now retired. You were in Mason from 03 to 16. You're a former firearms instructor. And what must go through your – retired now – what must go through your head when you see things like this? I mean, I can't imagine what it's like as someone who's been in this and understands this to watch it from the outside when you were in the mix so often.
Well, first of all, especially, living in Over the Rhine and being so close to downtown and literally hearing the sirens of the response, I could tell basically that this was something more than just a usual run, just because of the sirens coming from everywhere down Vine Street headed downtown. So right away, I'd start checking Twitter, checking the news, seeing what's going on. And then when you hear about it, it's hard not to, put yourself in the position of those officers. What would I do? How would I react? And then later on, as we look back over the incident, just kind of trying to make sense of it all. But I think ultimately, and I think that's what led us to be here today on the podcast, is what an amazing job that these officers and all of Cincinnati police and the first responders did in this situation. It was obviously a tragedy. And your heart aches for the victims and their families and really our community, because, this is like striking a blow to the heart of Cincinnati, right? Right down on Fountain Square.
The one thing I'm glad to have Derek in about, he ran for council last year. He's very politically engaged now as a 26-year police officer who is retired. He has this very common sense, level-headed, down the middle approach to policing. He sees both sides of police community relations, and calls it like he sees it, and I think calls it in the way that is probably the way most people think about this stuff. And so glad to have you in today to talk about this this incident.
How does this work logistically from a police standpoint? Because, how does it work in that everybody knows exactly where to go? And then also, what made this response special through that lens?
Sure. Well, going back kind of historically, response to these type of incidents used to be years ago just kind of happenstance. Just everybody kind of went and showed up and you just kind of winged it. Now, different systems have been put in place, and we've tried to standardize some of the approaches to incidents like this. It actually started out, there's a whole nomenclature. It's called the Incident Command System. Incident Command System. And it actually came out of the West Coast and California brush fires back in the 1960s and early 70s of how do we coordinate our response between law enforcement, the different, especially when you have multiple agencies, how do people know what to do, where to go, these types of things. The next big change that came about in policing, especially in response to these active shooter incidents, was after Columbine, where kind of the protocol was prior to that, that you would wait for a SWAT team to arrive or for some type of like overwhelming force before you went in. And what we saw with Columbine was, you know, in that time that they were waiting for the and just securing the perimeter, waiting for the SWAT team to show up, there were a lot of lives lost. A lot of damage was done. I mean, they're still inside shooting and you're just outside hanging out. I think we figured out that that's just not right. And that we have to take more decisive, quick, active steps to, you know, minimize the damage, the real damage that's going on. And that's exactly what you saw take place here. It's how we train. I know throughout my career, even in suburban departments, rural departments, now we're training for this because you never know. You know, we have these incidents in churches now, in schools. And we can get into the bigger discussion of that, but specifically to here, you know, it's almost like moving the pieces on a chessboard. You train and folks know what to do. And, you know, within that, obviously you're going to react because the situation is fluid. But there actually is a method to what looks like chaos. So, I almost make the analogy of, like if you watch a soccer game with 7-year-olds, like they all want to run to the ball rather than, you know, maintaining their spacing and their positions and those types of things. And that's what doesn't happen here. So you know that the first 2 or 3 or 4 officers are going to coordinate. They're going to figure out exactly where the problem is, where the shooter is. You're literally watching for people running, seeing where they're coming from, listening for shots. Get your first 2 or 3 officers together, whoever's are the first ones to show up, and you move.
So it's you know, we saw in the body cam video, we saw you know, the 4 officers move in and take out the suspect ultimately. So does it mean those were the first 3-4 officers on the scene then? And so everybody then essentially follows their lead?
Likely so. There may be some brief discussion of, you know, who's going and who's holding a perimeter. But essentially it's the first 3 or 4 that show up. You like to have 4 because if you're going to actually go in to a building and do a building search, you actually maintain like a diamond type formation so that you have 1 person at the front on the point, and then you've got all 4 directions covered. You've got your rear covered, a rear guard, and then both sides, and that's how you search the room. So if you're going down a hallway and you're searching either offices or classrooms, you break off and you practice this tactic. It's almost like a quasi kind of military operation, you know. But that's the concept. If you have to go in with 3 or 2, or you make the decision to even go in by yourself, that may happen. But 4 is kind of the magic number that you're shooting for. And then after that, as all the other resources, the other officers are arriving, you're setting up perimeters around the building. I mean, in this case, the best thing that happened was that he did not get out of that lobby. If he would have made it either upstairs in the building or managed to sneak out a side door, I mean, this tragedy could have been way worse.
I wrote this in the column over the weekend thanking the Cincinnati police officers, is that and it's not hyperbole, and I wasn't exaggerating, is that this we could have had the worst deadly mass shooting on our hands here. He had 250 rounds of ammo, and I think you make a great point, is if he had gotten up on some of the higher floors of this tower, who knows what, because you have a lot of open office space, and he had 250 rounds, and the worst, deadliest mass shooting, sadly, was last year in Las Vegas, and that was 58 deceased. I just think it's a fascinating thing, and hopefully I don't want us to wonk out here, but I think it's fascinating that everybody just sort of knows where to go. So even, you know, we were talking before the podcast that, you know, there were a set amount of officers who knew to go right to the hospital and block off streets there and for ambulances to come in. You know, they're off, so they are blocking off streets, what, 3 blocks perimeter around. How does this officer know to go to this street to block this one off and this one knows to go? It's just, it's amazing.
Yeah, so, you know, there is there's just a lot of planning that goes into it. They'll do tabletop exercises. It depends where it happens in the city.
Tabletop exercise, what do you mean by that? Like have little figures on a table, and
maybe not to that point, but you're just kind of walking through, you know, scenarios from a planning perspective, right, of what can happen. And then you actually go out and train. So, for example, in Mason, you know, we would have a day, and we, you know, we trained with other departments around us, especially for your smaller and suburban departments. You have to coordinate because you don't have just literally the number of police officers on duty as you would have in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you're Mason or Sharonville, or the Butler County Sheriff's Office, you're going to work with Middletown. You're going to have joint training exercises so that everybody's kind of on the same page and not responding in different ways. And so that's where just training just takes on, you know, just such an important role. And then everybody goes through that training. At least you have some sense of, you know, what's supposed to happen if you're a later arriving officer. Then obviously, you know, you have to have supervisors that are on point. You'll have, you know, under the, we talked about the incident command system. Well, part of that is, you know, you're going to have one person in charge, whoever that person is based on their rank or, you know, who's the shift supervisor at the time, and they start directing resources. And then within that, other people know their role. Somebody's, you know, start, you have your investigators that are, as soon as it transitions from an active incident, now it's a crime scene, and so they're responding. You have the other officers we talked about, you know, on a inner perimeter and outer perimeter. You have your media liaisons, all of these different things. And so it's almost like kind of like a football team. You know, everybody has their role, and then it just all, you know, if it's working right, it all comes together. And I think that's exactly what we saw here. Even as far as, you know, there are officers not running to the ball like the 7-year-old on the soccer field, but, you know, responding up to UC Medical Center because they know there's going to be multiple ambulances and things going there.
But unlike a football team, it's not like, you know, a football team during the season or even before the season is, what, you know, the NFL season is, what, five months?
Right.
So you're practicing every day throughout, you know, most,
and you know what plays you're running.
Yeah.
I mean, this is spontaneous play construction on the fly.
Right.
You're not training every day for 5 months, right? For this. I mean, what is a typical training? And let me point this out. Kudos to Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaac, who pointed out that his officers recently had just completed mass shooting trial. I don't know what it's, is it the mass shooting training.
Critical incident.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or active shooter response.
Active training. Shooter. Yeah. Active shooter training. Just recently, you know, before this happened, you know, how long is a training like that? Is it a day long? Is it a week long? A month long?
You know, and it differs by location. For example, in Warren County, we would train with all of the departments. So even a smaller department like a Hamilton Township, for example, smaller places like that are involved. And so the sheriff's department's there, and, you know, there's coordination ahead of time to say who all is going to train with us. But what we're trying to do is coordinate the response. I mean, you could have a mass incident, heaven forbid, you know, that you would need more than Cincinnati police in Hamilton County. You know, it could even be the response to, you know, major flooding, or, you know, heaven forbid, a terrorist type of incident where you just have to have more and more and more resources. But, you know, to have that level of coordination is just very helpful. And then within that, we need to have, you know, good folks that make good decisions under pressure and on the fly. And that's what you saw here. The one thing I wanted to point out about, specifically about the officers that we saw the body cam footage and that actually took out the shooter, mm-hmm. You know, their response was so quick. And when they came around the corner of the building, for those who have watched the video, if you haven't, you know, take a look at it if you can, if for no other reason. It's a traumatic video to watch, but if for no other reason, just to understand what our first responders go through, I think is important. But they're running towards the gunfire. They see him inside the lobby through the plate glass. And to me, this was a key. That glass is thick, but as we saw, the bullets went through it, that they're firing. And of course, it could work the other way too if he's shooting out the window. But they didn't wait to go inside the building. Actually addressed him through the glass. And as soon as he saw them, his attention was diverted from other possible victims to, uh-oh, the police are here. And now I'm no longer the hunter. I'm the hunted. So he's looking to make his escape, still shooting, and at some point his gun jammed, which, you know, was probably a favorable circumstance. But they actually fired on him through successfully through the plate glass window. And that was a decision that's excellent. We train for that typically with regard to vehicles, that if you have a car that's coming at you, running you over, you can shoot through the glass. But I think a natural human reaction may be to hesitate because there's some kind of barrier there. But, you know, if you're trained for the fact that, you know, the bullet's going to go through that, you're not going to let it stop you. They didn't hesitate, addressed him immediately, took him down, and that was the best thing that could have happened.
Can I ask you something about, as a former police officer, when the community rallies around everybody, first responders and the police, like they have in this, what does that do? How does that help the police officers that are dealing with this? Because I don't know how much we talk enough about the mental stress that every police officer goes through when it's something like this happens, the reality of this happening. And the city has been so behind everybody. You came in with a Cincy Strong t-shirt here, you know, and it's like it means something to somebody. How much does stuff like that, when you were out there, how much does stuff like that help you?
Well, having the support of the community, I think, is it just kind of puts some wind in your sails. You know, in this incident, we saw where after the fact, while the investigation is going on, we've still got officers that were down there on the scene on post for, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours, securing the crime scene, maintaining the perimeter. You can't just leave and go on a coffee break. You know, you have to be there. And so we saw a scenario where people were bringing water. People were bringing Gatorade. I heard Frisch's brought some burgers out or some food for the officers that were out there a long time. And that was just the start of it. And then we saw, you know, how really over the course of the week or Friday, we had the event there on Fountain Square and over the weekend, the vigil, and you really see the community coming together. I think it's just so important, but it's something that doesn't get talked about in law enforcement circles. You know, you kind of have this, I want to say, a macho kind of thing, but I think a lot of times even the officers themselves don't, you know, it's part of your job. It's what we do. You know, it's almost like a sign of weakness if you talk about, you know, how stuff impacts you. But I think it's very important. And I know the city and the department has resources, mm-hmm. you know, if you feel you need to talk to somebody, those types of things. But the reality is, man, it's a tough business, you know, even on just the day-to-day stuff. And the things that you see, it grinds on you after a while. It does. It wears on you. And, you know, I think back over the course of my career and, you know, fortunately I never responded to an active shooter or mass shooting event like this. But in other critical incidents, I could see it like it was yesterday. It was 20 years ago, mm-hmm. you know. And so I think it is a concern of, you know, how we carry that with us. I know actually from the state level now, they're working on getting PTSD added as a condition with regard to workers' compensation. And, you know, stuff like that is just so important to be able to help people. And it impacts people differently. People handle things in different ways. But I don't think it's any surprise to folks that you see some of the highest levels of alcoholism, mental health issues, suicide, and those types of things are in the law enforcement and first responder field just because, you know, you see this stuff and it's part of your day-to-day life. And then you go home to the kids, you know, for dinner and go to a baseball practice. And, you know, you're supposed to leave all that behind you. Mm-hmm. But it's a challenge. And so certainly having the support of the community and those types of things, you know, having your back, I think it really helps.
What's, you know, so I was at the press conference Friday with the chief. And so he said that of the four officers who fired shots, a total of 11 bullets, you know, that he had had extensive conversations with three of them, and they, you know, so they all take a period of time off, right?
Right.
Is there a typical time off that they would take? Or, I mean, I can't even imagine that, you know, you have this incredible adrenaline rush to take out this mass shooter. And then and then when the emotions settle, it's like, wow, I just, you know, took someone's life. And then you've got everybody saying you're a hero and all this tremendous love, which is great. It's like, emotionally though, how did, I mean, I know you said he hadn't gone through it, fortunately, but what do you what's a normal amount of time off that you would need? What are those police officers going through right now, do you think?
Well, so I don't know specifically how long our officers are going to be off from this incident. I can tell you, if it was me and I was a chief, I'd be like, take as much time as you need.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want somebody working, you know, out there working like everything's just fine if it's not. I think in the aftermath, you bring up a good point. Even though they were 100% justified, actually, they did exactly what they needed to do. The fact remains, and even though that person was doing evil things and shooting other people, you still took a human life. And so that's actually one of the questions that typically comes up in the hiring process. And I've actually known of some folks that were very far along in the hiring process and ended up either not being hired because the department didn't hire them, or they realized themselves that this wasn't a job for them. You have to go into this line of work knowing that you may be called upon, you know, you might have to take a life, and not really think about it for too long. And that's exactly what happened here. It's a right thing to do, but it's from a human perspective, it's not easy. So, yeah,
all we're doing right now is we're thinking, and rightfully so, we're thinking how awesome these officers were and how much they protected and served our community. But I think it's the general public. I know myself, like, you know, until you sit here and talk about it, we don't really think about how this affects them, you know, the next week, the rest of their lives, even. You know, what happens? Like, you don't see news stories on that kind of thing. And whatever happened to this officer who took out whatever mass shooter, this, you know, 10 years from now, where would these four officers be? How will this have affected them? We don't know.
No, we don't know. But I think it's, first of all, to all of my friends in law enforcement, I would just offer the suggestion that, you know what, the resources are out there. Don't be afraid to utilize them. I think, and I'm not saying this to any one specific person, but this is how this happens. People turn to other things that are harmful, whether it be alcohol or something else, in the way that we handle things. So, you know, I think it's just important to do what you need to do, you know. And then other than that, it's kind of life. But I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, at the end of the day, they're back out on the job and, you know, handling calls just like they were, you know. It was 9 a.m. It's like 9 a.m. You don't really expect this to happen, but it could happen at a moment's notice. And, you know, heaven forbid we don't have anything like it again anytime soon in Cincinnati.
And we in the general public don't think it's going to happen to us, but certainly Cincinnati police officers and Hamilton County sheriffs, they're aware it could happen to us. And they're always,
I mean,
they're,
at this point, it's happened so much in so many places. I don't know how you don't think that you might end up in the middle. I mean, and that to me, you know, as someone, you know, I have family who are their police officers. I ask them all the time, I don't know how you do it. Like, how hard it must be to try to get into that business now, knowing there is a chance, and arguably a good one, that you will end up in a situation or at least close connected to something like this sometime in your career, if not in the near future of your career, because we see so many of them, even if they're not as big as this one was or some of the other one was, there's so many of them that this is what the job is now. And that is insanely different than it was when you first got into being an officer 26 plus years ago.
Well, I was still carrying a revolver
yeah.
back then. It was so long. I don't feel that old, but yeah. And the thing is, I think, too, a couple things from the community perspective. You know, we get caught up in this because it's a big event. It's a big news event. It occurred on Fountain Square. But the reality is, and it's not just in the city. You know, it's kind of, you know, I worked in the suburbs, but, you know, live in the city. And it kind of grinds my gears a little bit when you hear people picking on, you know, Cincinnati. These things happen, you know, maybe not to with the frequency just because of it's a bigger city, so you're going to have stuff happen. But, you know, don't think that we're, you know, immune wherever it may be. We see these things happening. And the other thing is to realize for our first responders that while it might not be to the scale of this, you're handling stuff, you know, every day. Whether it be, you know, just yesterday we had, you know, the girl that was hit and killed by the hit skip car. Mm-hmm. And so somebody's out there, you know, handling that. And, you know, and so they're dealing with that. And so it just, it's a challenge, you know. You're working shift work, you're working midnights, the weekends, the holidays, the kid's birthday, just that day-to-day stuff. And then, you know, you're generally not talking to people when they're having a great day. You know, they're calling you because there's a problem, and our first responders are the last line when you don't know who else to call. And that's why I think also it's important for us to have those positive interactions in the community.
Yep.
That it's not just always all about that. I mean, that's kind of how it used to be before, you know, community policing became a kind of a buzzword, and some, you know, departments did it just by nature. But I think a lot of departments, you know, going back years ago, where you just responded, you rode around with the windows up, you went to calls, you handled it, and you got the heck out of there. Mm-hmm. And that's how it was. And so, you know, transitioning a little bit here, you know, I think it's important for, you know, for us as an organization, for police departments and for individual officers to, you know, have not every interaction be a negative one.
Yeah.
You know, to be in the community, to be in the schools with the kids, you know, talking to people when you can, having those positive interactions that builds a rapport, and then ultimately, we were talking about support in the community. It builds that, and then you do have that basis of support, and I think that's a real positive for everybody.
On my beat, you know, Michael Johnson, who plays for the Bengals, did a program where he literally, because kids will come out to be with football players, he would do an event where he would bring local police officers and kids in and let them all meet each other, so that these kids in the community can understand that police are not the enemy, they're not somebody to be scared of or to run from, and that and that helps bridge the gap so much that causes so many events. It's one of the greatest things I've ever heard of an NFL player doing, and it's a great thing that he does, and it's like that because that's part of it. It's an understanding and having those positive interactions and taking advantage of doing those when you can. Derek, I want to thank you so much for joining us, man. This was really incredible conversation, really insightful and thoughtful, and you know, great for you to join us here. And I hope that hey, maybe we'll have you back again sometime, hopefully under better circumstances.
I want to ask you one more thing. You brought the T-shirt in. I know Paul referenced it earlier. Cincy Strong, we'll give a shameless plug for Cincy shirts. Did you talk to the folks that sold it, and what are they giving the proceeds to anyone, or
So Darren Overholzer at Cincy Shirts, they've done some other stuff with the zoo and the Fiona shirts and donating proceeds to the zoo. You know, it's a locally owned small business, which I love to support here in Cincinnati. They have a location on Main Street in Over the Rhine, and another location on Hyde Park Square. Just really good. Really good dudes that love Cincinnati. And so, and it's a great design on the shirt. The Cincy Strong kind of became the hashtag afterwards with the fountain there. And so, yeah, they are donating the proceeds. Darren told me they've raised over $30,000.
Awesome.
So far. And
proceeds are, who are they? Did they say who they're going to?
To the victims, and I also believe the police department. I'm not sure exactly how that's being divvied up, but they have gotten pretty much a stamp of approval from the city. I don't think there's anything to worry about there. We know the money's going to a good place, and Cincy Strong. I think that's a way to look at this going forward. That our community has rallied. I think we're going to be stronger for it. We have people coming together and doing incredible things like this, and I'll be rocking my Cincy Strong shirt.
And they have a set up stand on the Fountain Square right now, you said?
Yeah, they have a stand down on Fountain Square as well. I'm not sure how long that's going to be there,
like,
but
a temporary stand or
something. Check out the guys at Cincy Shirts, and pick up your Cincy Strong shirt.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Derek. Really appreciate it, man, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
All right. Thanks again to Derek for joining us. I mean, just great stuff there with Derek, and I think perspective that you just haven't heard and conversations that you just don't get to hear very often. So I hope for those that listen to the TSC enjoy that you get a real unique view, I think, of this entire incident. Thanks to him and, you know, for being so kind for it with his time, for sure.
Totally agree.
All right. Let's try to lighten up a little bit. Can we?
Yeah,
it's a little heavy. It's been a heavy week for everybody. It's time to kind of move forward, and we try to keep it light here, but sometimes it's hard to. But we're gonna try to wrap it up that way. So we an idea was presented to us that I enjoy, and that was that if we're gonna be That So Cincinnati, we need to have a moment that is the That So Cincinnati moment of the week, right? I mean, because they happen all the time. We see them all the time, and it can give a proper representation of things that we view as That So Cincinnati, which sometimes are very good and sometimes are not so good, usually sometimes bumbling.
Sometimes.
So all right. So I think each week we should pick one. So do you have your That So Cincinnati, thing of the week? What do you got?
I do, and I think it's not as good as yours, but I'm going to give it a go. This to me is what is my So Cincinnati moment thing. Event of the week, and that's that Braxton Brewing, my favorite local brewery actually, is launching a new beer, the Pumpkin Pie Ale. And the reason why I say this is so Cincinnati is because Cincinnati loves them some beer, and Cincinnati loves them some ice cream, and this is beer and not just ice cream, but Grater's Pumpkin Ice Cream coming together into hopefully liquid goodness. Polly Campbell wrote about it. If I can I read this? Can I read this paragraph?
Read, yes, please.
Polly Campbell, our restaurant food expert, says the beer delivers the flavor of Grater's Pumpkin Ice Cream. It pours brown with an orange tinge and a 6.5% ABV. It's called Pumpkin Pie rather than pumpkin because it includes a hint of the flavor of crust.
Well, I like some crust. I love
That's not really Cincinnati, but
it's delicious.
It is delicious. It will be available in the tap room, which is celebrating it all weekend with a pumpkin patch atmosphere. Pumpkin patch atmosphere. In other bars around the city and in cans in regional Kroger stores. You also find it at Oktoberfest.
I love it. And you know what So Cincinnati is breweries combining with other. I mean, how many of these? They've done Grater's beer before.
They've done the Blackberry or black raspberry chip.
Yeah,
beer.
I mean, and just by, it seems like they're always looking for what's
in.
Like, and you get to, you even get to causes the Fiona beer, and it's like there's always the local companies are always trying to find ways to connect with others, and I think do a pretty good job of it.
Quick beer trivia for you: who made the Fiona beer?
Listerman.
Ding ding ding.
Yep. And another Listerman beer, my favorite beer name in the entire city, as someone who used to live there, is Don't Talk Shit About Norwood. So I feel like it's the best beer name in the entire city. I used to live there, and I saw, Norwood for life. Goodwood. I lived in Goodwood over in the President's.
Is that TSC's first bad word?
First bad word. I can bleep it. I can get the bleep people to come in here and do some bleeping, but that's the name.
I don't want the big dog on us. So.
It's the name. We can do a proper bleeping, but that's what it's called.
I'm just kidding.
I have a That's a Cincinnati moment.
Drum roll.
Very good. That was like straight out of Christmas Vacation.
Yeah, it was.
On my street, which is no outlet both directions in Oakley, they're doing these repavings all over the place, and they have had signs up saying that they're going to be doing these between this date and this date, so 3-date period. They put a little thing on your doorknob that says, "Hey, here's the deal of what we're doing." It usually gets done. It takes a half day. Usually, get done the first day on the period of what it says now. Just please make sure your car is out of the areas that are marked off so we can do this as efficiently as possible. Well, the first one, I believe, was from It was 3 days at the end of August that were first listed. I've dubbed this Carmageddon is what it is, because every single day that they put these up, everyone on our street, because it's no outlets both ways, has to go on the perpendicular street further down. We're almost down halfway to St. Cecilia's from where I live. And so people are having to park. People in suits, people that are going to work, having to park way far away from where they are so these people can come in. Well, the first day goes by and they didn't come. And okay, well, whatever. So the next day, everybody moves all their cars again and no parking spaces. But you're walking halfway down the street to go. They don't show up. Then the next Friday, about midday, the signs are just gone. Well, someone apparently, I think, had come through and taken the signs and ripped them off the posts and just sat them down in the grass, but still nobody came. Then all of a sudden, another one that shows up and says, actually, now new dates are on there. They're going to be here between 9-4 and 9-6. So 9-4 comes, everybody moves their cars again, and everybody goes all the way up, and guess what happens? You probably know. They don't show up. Next day, because 9-4 through 9-6, we're now at 9-5. Everybody moves their cars, people in suits, walking all the way down the street. Nobody shows up. They still have not shown up. They did not come over the weekend. They have not come during the week. I don't know if they just said we're abandoning this project altogether, or we're on some sort of like punked show where they're just having fun watching us all attempt to park these cars on the street. But because you also have to kind of plan your day, because if they're coming through doing this, you could get your driveway blocked in. So if you're working from home or whatever, as I do sometimes, you got to know that you might not even be able to leave if you're parked in the driveway. So you all sometimes can't even park in your own driveway because you might not be able to get out.
One simple question for you.
Yeah. Yes.
If it's if there's no outlet on both ends, how in the heck do you get in?
Well, it's just one street in. So it's a three. There's three. It's a dead end street. I live on a essentially double cul-de-sac, but you just one street in. You go straight out, but there's one way in, and they, you know, you can't, if you're on either end, it doesn't matter.
I know, it's just funny. Like, as you said, it's a no outlet on both ends. I'm like, well, then.
Well, it comes down and drops you off to one street that ends as a cul-de-sac on both ends. That's it. You just drive in.
Thank you.
It's very simple.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, Engineer.
I mean, if you'd ever been to my house to have a couple of pops, you would know this.
Do you host the cornhole tournament?
It alternates. It's at my house every other year. Every other year. So,
and then it's out in the suburbs.
Yeah, well, yeah. My buddy has a ton of space out in Hebron.
I thought it was Northern Kentucky.
So we'll go out there. He's got a pool.
That's where we had it this year.
Yeah. Cornhole tournament is so big. I don't have the kind of time to talk about how great it is, but we just celebrated our 15th year, the quinceañera.
What's the we're getting off, but what's the trophy? What's the trophy? What do you win?
It's huge. Well, first of all, you win money, and then because everybody
is why I've not participated.
First of all, you win money, and second of all, the trophy is huge. And there's two of them, so both partners win. You get your name. That it's like sort of like the Stanley Cup, where it has all the previous winners on the bottom, and it gets engraved every year with the winners from that year, and it's a giant trophy and. You get to keep it for a year, and then you got to bring it back. We also have a trophy for whoever finishes last.
Yeah.
It is a dead plant that was at our house one year. So there's two dead plants, and we actually have a competition to see who is the worst.
Is it a 15-year-old dead plant? The same, or is it just
actually the
one that dies over this year?
The trophy for the worst player actually only started about 5 years ago.
Okay.
So it's about a 5-year-old dead plant. And the only thing you have to do, you get to keep it at your house for a year, you know, as a remembrance of your performance or your failures. And you have to add a piece of garbage to it that you collected during that day that you were so bad because you were trash. So we have this garbage-ridden dead plant that you win if you're the worst. And we very much keep score as to who's going to be the worst and then create an embarrassing competition that they have to go through in order to see who is the worst.
You know what hosting a 15-year-old cornhole tournament is?
It's so Cincinnati, isn't it? Hey, that's so why. Cincinnati. Look, I feel like that's why I'm here. That's why we've named it this. That's why I'm here on this thing, because I can tell stories like that.
You are a very good storyteller. And
it's not that I'm a good storyteller. It's that I have.
You can tell So Cincinnati stories.
I can tell So Cincinnati stories, which is what that one is. All right. Great episode, Jason. I hope a reminder to everybody. Thank you to everybody that listened to the first episode. Go back and give that a listen to. Lots of important stuff we went into there. We talked about the banks and the streetcar and all kinds of other good stuff. So, you know, we're bringing these to you every single week. So every Wednesday morning, you will have the That's So Cincinnati podcast waiting for you wherever you listen to your podcast. Whether you're on Google Play or iTunes, wherever your podcast app is, we are there. So make sure you just search that. Please subscribe. Please comment. Please tell your friends so that we can keep doing this. We want to convince our bosses to let us keep doing this. And the more of you that listen, the more that they'll let us sit in this room and talk about beers and cornhole tournaments and but then also actually I think really important stuff. So thanks again to Derek Bauman.
And don't be afraid, like in your feedback, don't be afraid to be critical. We want to make this better. I think the best feedback I got from the first episode was this listener loved it, but she said, let your guests talk, do not talk over your guests. And you know what, I had that in mind today when we talked to Derek, and
guess what, it was better for it.
Absolutely.
Because Derek was fantastic. He was better than you. Not that you weren't good, but he was really good.
Oh, he's way better than me.
Yeah. All right. We will talk to you next week on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And have a good one.